This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. It's January, it's cold, it's gloomy, it's dark, but don't worry, come and sit by the roaring fire of warming insight that always will be Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch, and in this episode, I'm joined by Alex Wood from the hit BBC Radio 4 series Scam Secrets. Over the course of a decade, Alex stole millions of pounds through a string of increasingly sophisticated scams. But after serving his last prison sentence, Alex turned from poacher to gamekeeper. Now working with banks, police and the media, Alex's mission is to explain the psychology of scamming and how fraud literally works from the inside out. So I asked Alex to share his scamming career secrets, including how he emotionally distanced himself from victims, the immense feelings of control and power that scamming fueled within him, and why prison taught Alex more about scamming than it ever did about stopping. So after the following messages from our sponsors, let's get inside the mind of one of the UK's most notorious scammers, Alex Wood.
The FCA is clear. You must show that vulnerable customers get equally good outcomes. Learn how in our Outcomes and Vulnerability course on the 28th of January. Sign up at moneyadvicetrust.org/vulnerability.
Alex, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. Now, for listeners who do not know your story already, can you briefly introduce yourself, what you used to do for a living, and explain what you do now?
Yeah, so my name is Alex Wood. Well, I used to be a criminal, Chris. I used to be a prolific financial fraudster, and over, I think, 25 years committed fraud as a career. I committed a whole range of fraud. I mean, everything from sort of pretending to be the Duke of Marlborough, and getting to stay in luxurious hotels all over the place for free with never being asked to pay for anything or swipe a card. So really audacious frauds, all the way through to committing vast and very damaging authorized push payment frauds, where I would call people up and pretend to be their bank and fleece them of their life savings. And I'm ashamed of the damage that I caused in that. But now I, after sort of three pretty lengthy stints in prison, have reformed, and I now help society to protect from people like myself. And I work with the BBC, so I'm a part of the Scam Secrets team. So it's a weekly show on Radio 4 to help raise public awareness of red flags that they should be looking out for and to sort of protect the public. So I've had two very different sides to my life, and I've left the dark side. You'll be good to know.
That's fantastic. And we've achieved that podcast nirvana where someone from one podcast comes onto another one. So we've reached those heavenly levels. Now, your early life was very different. And this is really interesting because this episode is very much about the way in which fraudsters, scamsters approach this. You're a child prodigy to serious fraud. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that. What do you think that sudden loss of identity and direction might have done to you?
Yeah, so I used to be a violinist, and I was a very gifted child prodigy, as you said, and played the violin all over the world. I played for the Queen quite a few times and toured all across the USA and Europe as a kid, which is an unusual life. And then when I was in my early 20s, I was earning a lot of money. I was playing on sort of film soundtracks and so on, and playing all the time and doing a lot of practice and earning a lot of money. And then I developed repetitive strain injury in my wrist, and so it was in my right arm and in the bowing arm. And that led to, over a few months, the total collapse of my career, because with repetitive strain injury, my wrist was seizing up and I couldn't work it, as it was becoming very painful. And I sought a lot of sort of medical intervention, and the only cure for RSI is total rest. So I literally couldn't play anymore, and as soon as I would pick up the violin again, the symptoms would return. And I had, when I was earning a lot of money, I had an expensive lifestyle. So I had an expensive mortgage. I think my mortgage was, £6,000 a month, which sounds like an eye-watering sum, but if you're earning £25,000, you can pretty much afford that. But then as soon as the income stopped, I was in a very desperate financial situation within a few months, and it was in that sort of backdrop that I committed my first fraud offence.
That's interesting. So kind of on that trail of your first fraud offence. Now, without giving the game away totally and technically, can you describe what this journey looked like? What a typical fraud looked like from your perspective at the time? And probably more importantly, what you needed from victims psychologically for it to work? Yeah.
So that's a really interesting question. I could openly discuss the techniques that I used at the time, because now really a lot of the frauds I'd perpetrated, you wouldn't be able to do because industry has learnt from what I did. And although the banks and the police are always slightly behind the fraudsters, because obviously they need to firstly work out what's happening before they can respond. But it all revolves around trust, creating false trust. And there's two elements to a fraud, no matter whether it's a an authorized push payment fraud, or it's a hotel fraud, or it's a credit card fraud, or someone trying to defraud you, Chris, of a couple of beers in the pub. It all revolves around a false representation and then an unlawful gain, or exposing a victim to a loss. So basically, the false representation of the lies, and then you have the loss or the unlawful gain. So the only thing that ever changes is the lies and how the lies are delivered. Now, when I look back to my first fraud, I would tell the lies face to face. I'd be talking to somebody. I'd be convincing them that they should invest in this company I've just set up. It's going to be the next Microsoft. I had this lack of remorse, this lack of empathy, which really sort of pervaded my character, where I could look at somebody front them and look in the whites of their eyes and tell them that this was the next best thing, and I knew it wasn't, and I was just focused on getting that money. Over time, I then realized actually it is so much easier to just commit fraud remotely. And so that's when I got involved in authorized push payment fraud, phoning people up. And in that case, the lies were, I'm phoning from your bank, and I'd spoof the phone number so they could see the phone number. It looked like it was the bank, so that builds trust. And the lies then were, there's some suspicious activity. I'm in the fraud team at your bank. We need to do some test payments, or we need to move money to a safe account. And the losses, the unlawful gain that I was able to achieve were becoming eye-watering. I remember one phone call. I called a business for something like 40 minutes and stole £1.3 million. And you think, well, God, that's just over half an hour and he's made £1.3 million. If you wanted to make that in a sort of investment fraud, you might have a long back and forth with a victim. There might be a huge paper trail. There'd be contracts. I was in prison once with somebody who got caught because his fingerprints were on a contract that he sent somebody to sign. And that led them to him when he got arrested for some sort of speeding offence, and they had to take his fingerprints, and it just all unraveled. But now with the sort of sophistication we're seeing, deep fake, artificial intelligence and so on, you can deploy a very sophisticated fraud without any contact and without ever meeting somebody or even talking to them directly on the phone, because you can clone voices and so on. So the essence of the fraud is always going to be the same. You have the lies and the loss, but with the sophistication of tech now, the lies are very, very hard to recognize.
What did you need from the victims of the fraud psychologically for it to kind of really work? Because there must be many occasions where it didn't work.
Those occasions became fewer over time. So I needed psychological buy-in. I needed them to trust what I was saying. So I had to, psychologically, as a perpetrator, you want to really try to rush the victim, try to get the fraud over the line. But I realized that the public are warned about fraudsters rushing you, and the police warn potential victims that fraudsters will say this is too good to be true offer, or you're told that all your money is at risk, you need to move it to a safe account in the next minute, or you've got 10 minutes to decide on this investment or you'll never be a millionaire. So there's this rush. And I recognize that the public are expecting to be rushed. And so I took the opposite approach, which you think that's counterintuitive. And I would say things like, we're going to need you to move your money to a safe account. I'm from the bank because you can see my number and I've given you my name. But fraudsters are out there and we need you to be safe. So if you don't trust me fully, hang up the phone now and just come into the branch. Now, you think, well, what fraudster in his right mind would say that? Because, you're not going to tell your mark that they can hang up and go to the bank. They're like, well, surely we can trust this guy because he's saying things that we're told a fraudster would never say. So I literally became so good at committing fraud that I would take the completely contrary approach to what we'd think would be reasonable. And by doing that, I was able to very subtly convince the victim that I was from the bank and that they could trust me. And by doing that, the success, when employing those very dark psychological techniques, the success rates went through the roof.
You've said in interviews that I've listened to with you before that you did not think about your victims at the time. And I just wondered, how did you manage to keep that emotional distance?
So the first couple of major, like the telephone banking frauds where people thought I was from the bank, the first couple, when I sat down and tried this, you know, and it was successful. So I remember the first day I committed one of these frauds, I phoned up, I think it was a law firm, and stole £100,000. And I thought, oh my word, I've done it. The police are going to fly through the window in a minute. I need to go and destroy all my phones, destroy the laptop. I was panicking, thinking that I'm going to get apprehended very quickly. I was thinking about the victim. I was thinking, what are they going to do? I mean, fraudsters, you'll hear this a lot, will say that fraud is a victimless crime. But yeah, you've heard fraudsters say that. It's a victimless crime. The banks will just refund the victim. The victim will have an initial shock, phone the bank and get refunded. And it's the banks that pay and the banks can afford it and everyone hates the banks. And it's like the Robin Hood mentality, right? But in fact, I did eventually come to realize that the true extent of the damage that fraud can visit upon a victim, where it's not just the loss, you know, even if a victim does get refunded, it can take a while to get refunded, but it's the psychological damage. And I remember hearing a victim describe how after I'd called them up, and it was the one that I took over £1 million from this person's business. But I remember him saying that every time the phone rang after that, he wouldn't trust it. He couldn't pick it up. He found his relationships were coming under pressure. He lost trust in other people. He would panic. He would lose trust in people, and he put his relationships under strain. And when the phone rang, he would panic. And the thought that I'd caused this level of harm was something that I'd never really considered before. And to realize actually fraudsters are deluded when they describe fraud as victimless, it's profoundly damaging. With the work I do on the BBC, the Scam Secrets show, one of my two other colleagues is a lady called Dr. Liz Carter, and she's a forensic linguist and criminologist, and she looks into the language of a scam or language of a fraud. And she deals with a lot of victims and said to me recently, I think she said it on an episode, but a lot of victims, because of the, especially with romance fraud, because of the level of the harm, the level of emotional harm, the language that victims use is comparable to the language used by victims of sexual offences. They experience a real sort of deep level of psychological harm, not just the sort of physical effects, but also the emotional effects and the psychological effects. And victims of fraud speak in very similar terms when describing the impact of the offence.
So this moment of epiphany that you were talking about just earlier came much later in your career. But just to kind of, so we get a sense of kind of being in your shoes at the time, I've read you describing the thrill of feeling bigger than the banks and the police. And I just wondered, what did that sense of power or control feel like? And how did it shape your judgment over time? Was it a positive superpower, or was it what brought you down in the end?
Very negative superpower. I certainly did feel that. So with this authorised push payment fraud, sort of 9 months going around stealing £1 million or £2 million every day, there was no evidence of the police doing any work. I had a lot of sort of security cameras around my house, and I'd monitor them, and there was nobody. It was a quiet street I lived on. There was no evidence of any activity. I'd learned a perfect modus operandi to hit banks and to hit victims' accounts, and I'd perfected it and was able to deploy it very, very easily and with very little thought. And so I did grow to believe that I can make £1 million a day, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. And because the number's spoofed, there's no way anyone can trace a call back to me. And so I was very surprised when I got arrested and realized quickly that I wasn't cleverer than the banks, and they'd been listening and putting it all together and working closely with the police, who'd mounted a very proactive investigation. And it turns out I was under observation for several weeks before I got arrested, and they'd built up a very strong case.
So you were then imprisoned three times, I think, over the course of this period of your life. Did prison clearly didn't deter you the first or second time? You've described it as educating you.
Even the third time, prison was no deterrent. The problem with prison, if you're a white collar offender, and I don't want to inspire anybody listening who might think, well, hang on, let's go and try a bit of fraud. Prison, if you're a fraudster, is very, very easy. Fraudsters all prisoners are vetted when they go into custody, and prison officers for the first week are just working out who's who, who's dangerous, who's vulnerable, who is in a gang, who smokes drugs, who's violent, poses a potential risk towards officers, and so on. Fraudsters go in and they're instantly classified as being in the lowest risk category. You know, they're not going to go around stabbing officers. They're not going to go fighting other prisoners and smoking drugs. So they're siloed off. Fraudsters are all put together in a wing and they're sort of dumped together, and there might be one or two officers to look after that wing just in case anyone gets ill or anything like that. It's very, very easy work for the officers because everyone's polite. And inevitably, fraudsters just talk about fraud all day, how they got caught, all the assets they had, the watches, the cars. And if you think of that type of environment, which is unrestrained chat about financial crime, inevitably it leads to further conspiracies being formed and partnerships being formed. And I remember hearing conversations, you know, somebody said to somebody else, oh, how did you get caught, mate? And the guy said, ah, oh, my, you know, I didn't launder money in the right way. I should have done it differently. And I heard him say, well, you should speak to my mate, Aaron down the hallway. I'll introduce you later. He's the launderer. And I remember somebody else saying to me, man, I've got this bank account that can take £10 million without any problem. We just need someone with a posh voice to phone the victim and get the money out. And so we formed a conspiracy. It's this constant breeding ground. And then all the officers in the prison, they're on the wings with all the kids that want to kill each other and fighting all day long, and the alarms going off all the time. And there might be 30 or 40 officers on that wing, but then the fraudsters are just all forgotten about. And after a couple of months, without any problem, they're sent to open prison. There's another real issue, Chris, with the sentencing regime for fraud. Whether you steal $1 million or $1 billion, the maximum sentence under the Fraud Act 2006 is 10 years. If you plead guilty, you get a third off. So you get about 6. For a first fraud offence, you'll probably get 5 or 5.5 if it's over $1 million. But if we say 6 years, because it's easy to work out. So you used to do half of that, right? But you now do 40%. So you would be serving just under sort of just over 2.5 years if you got the maximum sentence for fraud. As a low risk offender, you'll be sent to open prison. And so that 2.5 years will be spent, I think when I was in open prison, I was working in the community 5 days a week. So I was working in a charity shop 5 days a week. So you're let out 5 days a week. Every weekend, your partner or your family or your friends can come and see you and take you out for what's called a town visit. And I remember Jeffrey Archer was caught drinking wine on a town visit one occasion. And then 1 week a month for a whole week, you can go home. So for 2 years, if you think of prison and what we see on TV, like bang up and this horrible environment, and you think, great, well, somebody's committed fraud against me, they're going away for 2 or 3 years, good riddance. Well, actually, no, they're in the community. And really, I mean, it's some of the things you read about. But every day we see about somebody just walking out of open prison and going on the run and absconding. And, you know, it's possible. You can just stroll out the front gate. It's really not what society needs to bring about rehabilitation.
Well, it's really interesting. You talked earlier about that moment where you things change for you significantly. But I just want to focus on, how do you walk away from something? And we were talking before the recording started about some of the work I've done in the past around addiction. And this has many of the characteristics of perhaps compulsive or addictive behavior. And I don't know if you think about yourself in those particular terms. Yeah. I was wondering, how do you walk away from this and go from being a black hat to a white hat, if I can put it in those terms?
Yeah. Well, so there's a few interesting psychological drivers. So when I look at other high value, high harm fraudsters, so fraudsters that have caused chaos in people's lives, stolen huge amounts of money, and despite having successfully made £1 million one day, will come back the next day and try again for another million. I mean, you can't really fathom that, but people will think, well, surely $1 million is enough, you can just stop now. But fraudsters have this greed driver that predicates everything they do. But when I look at myself back then, and when I look at a lot of other people who committed similar frauds, I recognize a lot of traits of antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, which is known in the US as psychopathy. And Dr. Hare, I think it was, he identified the traits of a psychopath, and you can look at the traits and sort of do a rating of, anyway, I was a total psychopath when I did that test. So traits such as lack of remorse, lack of empathy, superficial charm, grandiosity, lying, cunning and manipulative behavior, sexual, you know, lack of any sort of sexual restraint or inability to form lasting relationships and so on. And all of these traits, I was, you know, seeing that, I was able to identify that I was totally an antisocial person. And everybody else, and looking back to those conversations, everybody else on that prison wing who was in for a high value fraud was ranking very highly on that score as well. And I think that when you often hear in financial institutions, try and think like a fraudster, try and think how a fraudster might be doing this and that, and people try and stand in those shoes. I think it's time to realize, really, unless you've been there and done it, unless you really have lived that life, you can't imagine it. So, you know, you think of a psychopath being a serial killer and running around the street with a knife, but actually they can be running companies, they can be running governments, as we see right now, right? I'm not going to name anybody, but it's very pervasive in society, and I think it's important to recognize that you know, one's character flaws. And I did, and I you know, I still have those flaws, but I manage them because I can recognize them. And you know, I don't want anyone to think, well, if he's a psychopath, you know, you can't just suddenly change. So maybe this is a scam. Maybe this whole reformation is a deep fraud. But I think it's about managing one's character traits.
One last question. Wanda, what do you see the future holding for yourself, but also for kind of a fraud prevention as well?
So for myself, I think I'm just going to sort of keep doing what I do. And what I find fascinating is how the sophistication changes, as we move from AI into quantum AI, for example, I think it's very important to have a really deep insight into the foundations of the fraud mindset. Because if you can understand that, then you can understand how the bad guys will be using AI or quantum AI, for example. If we look at the sort of landscape of the threat landscape, as I call it, we're seeing slightly fewer attempted frauds, so slightly less attempts at frauds. And you think, well, we're hearing that fraud's getting worse and the losses are getting higher and higher. And we look at why that is, and it's because the fraudsters are becoming much more sophisticated. So rather than sit down and make 50 phone calls in a day and one might be successful, using things like ChatGPT or deepfake clones, you could do 5 attempts in one day and they'll all be successful. So that the losses are starting to really spike, but also the number of attempts are going down because of that sophistication shift, if you like. So I think it's important to understand, you know, the tech and how it's developing and how the bad guys are going to be using it. I shared recently a video that I obtained from the dark web, in which a West African crime gang were defrauding a woman of her life savings, and the gang were advertising this tech, this AI deepfake technology, to be licensed by other criminal gangs. And they were saying, look, this is how easy it is to take £100,000 off an elderly woman. You use this tech. And I looked at it and you could see this West African guy talking. The deepfake tech had taken something like 1,000 impressions from different parts of his face, like how they created like Gollum and the one in Harry Potter, Dobby. And it was exactly the same tech. And they were beaming these 1,000 pinpoints onto it, and they'd created an Asian face. And so the woman thought she was talking to a retired Chinese dentist whose wife had recently died, and he was a widower, but actually she was talking to this ruthless criminal. This is being deployed on a live basis. So we think, well, how can big tech fight back? How can the banks fight back? And it's very difficult when it's being deployed live. So that's why things like transaction monitoring is very important to banks and risk professionals, being able to identify unusual patterns of transactions on a live basis. Because the money will be moved around the world in a matter of seconds.
Alex Wood, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
That was Alex Wood. If you want to find out more about Alex, do take a listen to BBC Radio 4's series Scam Secrets. It's an absolutely fascinating listen. Or search out Alex Wood, FRSA, on LinkedIn. And that's about it. So until next time, keep yourself scam safe, keep those around you safe too, and keep on remembering that vulnerability matters.
Vulnerability Matters was produced by Amandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.